Hello again. All three branches of government are involved in impeaching a president. Charges are made by the House, followed by trial in the Senate, presided over by the Chief Justice of the United States, the current chief, a conservative, John Roberts. What role will he play?
I believe John Roberts would try to do nothing that would steer the ultimate resolution for Donald Trump toward a conviction or acquittal.
The trial is likely to start next week, and we'll hear more later from Joan Biskupic. She's a biographer of Chief Justice Roberts. But first, climate change and this year's campaign for president. Is that existential issue getting the attention it deserves? During his first campaign and often afterward, Donald Trump insisted that climate change was a hoax. Does he still believe that? He was asked that question directly during a press conference late last week.
What is your position on global warming? Do you think it's a hoax?
No, not at all. Nothing's a hoax. Nothing's a hoax about that. It's a very serious subject.
But even though he's finally conceded that climate change is real, Trump's war on environmental protections is still very much underway. But it's part of what he calls a drive to create new jobs, which he announced at that same conference we just heard from.
Today, we're taking another historic step in our campaign to slash job-killing regulations and improve the quality of life for all of our citizens. In the past, many of America's most critical infrastructure projects have been tied up and bogged down by an outrageously slow and burdensome federal approval process.
Michael Hiltzik is business columnist for the LA Times. And Michael, it's always good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
Job-killing regulations, that is often a phrase which really means let's get rid of all those environmental controls.
Right. Well, of course, this is a platitude, and of course it speaks in favor of developers and builders and really against the interests of communities, nearby residents, people who have a real interest in how a building or a project is built and where it goes.
The president says that he wants the cleanest air and the cleanest water, and yet he has ordered reviews of 95 regulations, which include a lot of the regulations under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
Yeah. Once again, this is basically Trump just talking. We've had 3 years of rollbacks and have threatened rollbacks, as you said, of clean air regulations, of clean water regulations. We've had rollbacks of endangered species regulations. And whose interests are we really talking about? Well, we're talking about the interests of big business and builders.
Well, what is this an order to all of his regulatory agency heads to review the regulations? Is that really a demand to cut back?
I think all the agency heads, secretaries, his appointees certainly will take it that way. I mean, the basic theme of Trump's statements about all of these is we want fewer regulations. We want to get essentially government off the backs of the people so that big business can saddle up. And I think that really is what we're seeing. We see it not only in terms of environmental regulations, but all sorts of other regulations on business and commercial entities.
Well, now this announcement at the news conference where we heard those sound bites was interesting because he was surrounded by people in hard hats and others obviously related to the employment issue. And of course, this comes at a time of impeachment and a time when we're worried about foreign affairs. What do you think this has to do with the election?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, he's not really saying anything differently from themes that he's been articulating really from the time of his presidential campaign. Maybe he's pushing it a little harder. Maybe he's scheduling more events like this. But I think we should also keep in mind that construction trade unions and commercial and industrial developers have always been hand in hand in promoting fewer regulations for big projects. So that's certainly not new. The idea that Trump is buying into this argument is not new for him. but it's certainly a departure from the last administration, which maybe that has something to do with it, too.
Are environmentalists horrified by it?
I think environmentalists have been consistently horrified by the direction that this administration is taking. And, of course, I think we have to keep in mind that there are reasons for these regulations, and they're rooted in abuses and problems that really developed over the previous, really, 50, 60, 70 years. Look, we got the National Environmental Policy Act and the EPA under Richard Nixon, who nobody would mistake for a liberal, but that's because he was responding to reality on the ground.
So reality has changed to some extent in that the air is cleaner, the water is cleaner as a result of the EPA and the Nixonian approach to things. Now Trump wants to turn it back the other way.
That's right. And the irony here is that while we do have cleaner water and cleaner air than we did when Nixon created the EPA and when Congress passed the NEPA, I think the issue is much more urgent now because there's much more agreement, in fact, almost unanimous agreement, that we need these sorts of environmental regulations to combat climate change. You know, 50 years ago, there was still, I think, a legitimate debate among scientists as to whether man-caused climate change was a reality. We don't have that debate anymore. We know it. We have a very good idea of what regulations and what controls we need to impose on commercial and industrial activities. And we have a good idea of what the cost is. And I think the cost-benefit calculation, that is all in favor of the benefits.
But again, the president appears to be looking at it in a very different way. You've written about another issue that has come up. We've been talking about very direct challenges to federal environmental protections, but there is another initiative against efforts to address climate change from the Trump majority on the Securities Exchange Commission, which is cracking down on resolutions by shareholders in major corporations, not just resolutions, but lawsuits as well. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, this has been very high on the wish list of big corporations and big corporate managements for years and years and years. We've seen over the last few decades a surge in the interest of shareholders, not just activist shareholders, but I think general shareholders, in holding their corporate managements to a greater degree of accountability than has been traditional. Corporate management, CEOs, boards of directors are very uncomfortable with this trend because they don't like to be told what to do or how to run their companies. But there's been a lot of success by shareholders and shareholder activists in bringing some more accountability to corporate managements over the years. And now we have an SEC that as you said, is Republican-controlled, it's really Trump-controlled, that is preparing to roll back the access that shareholders have to their managements through the proxy. That is the agenda of corporate annual meetings.
So what are some of the successes that these shareholder actions have been able to chalk up?
Well, I think we've seen probably the most notable success has been on the environmental field. We can point to Chevron, which faced ever higher votes asking for action on methane, a greenhouse gas, over the years. And finally, when it looked like a shareholder resolution on that topic was close to getting a majority, which is a remarkable level for shareholder voting, Chevron basically capitulated and took steps to do what the shareholders had been asking for, more disclosure and more self-regulation of methane emissions. So that's a big success. We've also seen a lot of success in changes in corporate governance, things like separating the chairman and the CEO's job so that you have more diversity at the top of a corporation. That's been a trend that we've seen a lot of success at, and has also been driven by these sort of activist shareholders.
When you talk about a majority of shareholders, when you consider all of the shares that are owned by hedge funds and other major institutions, that's pretty hard to get.
It's In fact, it's almost impossible to get, which is why a shareholder resolution that gets 40% or even 30%, and in some contexts 10%, is remarkable and will force a lot of responsible corporate managements to start paying attention. Most shareholder votes are routine. They're cast by institutional investors who don't pay much attention, whose tendency is to vote as management asks them to vote. So when we do see 10, 20, 30, 40%, that really does make a lot of management sit up and take notice.
One of the things that they have pointed to and have been able to reveal are what are referred to as stranded assets. What does that mean?
Well, those are cases in which corporations have made investments that are no longer functional and need to be disclosed. So we've seen a lot of action on stranded assets. We've seen a lot of action also on asking for disclosure of political contributions. That's something that the SEC has been really wishy-washy about, but shareholders have taken the reins or the bit in their teeth and forced, really prompted a lot of corporations to make more disclosures. And of course, that's very important for our electoral system.
Doesn't stranded assets also mean investment in properties that now appear to be valuable because they would make accessible various kinds of fossil fuels, but which may not be usable if, in fact, climate change leads to regulations where you can't develop them anymore?
Well, that's very important because we are moving away from a fossil fuel energy economy. So, yes, we want to know what corporations, where those investments are, what the exposure is of a lot of corporations to that problem.
What do you think is happening on the Democratic side for the campaign for president in terms of climate change? They all talk about it in general terms, but has anybody really gone into it to any extent?
I don't think they've gone into it as much as they have to. I think there's always a lot of notice to how little the political debates, the televised debates, really spend on climate change. And I think that's because, first of all, it's a very complicated issue and a very complex issue. It's hard to understand. It's hard to reduce to sound bites. And there are real costs that I think candidates who are really just at this point in the early stage of running for office, there are real costs that they want to be wary about talking about. Climate change is, in fundamental ways, an economic issue. How much do we want to spend to fight it? Which are the what incumbents are going to be faced with a lot of costs? ExxonMobil certainly its business plan is going to have to change. Do we really want that to happen? And how much commitment does the public have to these costs? I think what we're seeing lately, especially with some very notable events that can be attributed to climate change, Australia being one, where there's much more interest on the part of the public to doing something. And what we really need is leadership to help the public understand what has to be done, how quickly it has to be done, and how expensive it's going to be. At this point, we haven't seen a lot of political candidates step forward and take that issue on.
Well, thanks very much for setting us up for the next segment of our program. We'll talk about whether the candidates were really asked by the moderators anything much about climate change, and secondly, what they were able to say about it when they were. Michael Hiltzik, great to have you back on our program.
It's great to be back.
We talked to Michael Hiltzik the day before that final debate between the Democratic candidates leading up to next month's Iowa caucuses, and they were asked about climate change. We'll hear what they have to say in a moment, but first, here's Mark Hertzgard, environmental correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. He's also executive director of Covering Climate Now. Mark, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Covering Climate Now is an effort to bring more news coverage to climate change. Did the hosts have an obligation to ask the candidates about it?
They did, and they did actually ask them, but one can't help but notice that they waited till the very end of the debate to do that. And indeed, when the Democratic Party candidates tried at the beginning of the debate, a number of them tried to quite correctly include climate change observations when answering questions about trade policy, for example. The journalist actually said, no, we're going to stick with trade. And Senator Sanders corrected them to say that climate is part of the trade issue. So I'm afraid to say that although it is better than it was 4 years ago when the networks essentially ignored the climate issue during the presidential debates of 2016, that we've still got a long ways to go.
Okay, let's hear a little bit about what they had to say. All six Democratic candidates, when they finally got around to it, were asked about it. And the first direct question went to Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He said it was an urgent issue from coast to coast.
We are going to have to use federal funds to make sure that we are supporting those whose lives will inevitably be impacted further by the increased severity and the increased frequency. And by the way, that is happening to farms, that is happening to factories, and that disproportionately happens to Black and Brown Americans, which is why equity and environmental justice have to be at the core of our climate
plan. Thank you, Mayor Buttigieg.
Now, Tom Steyer, the billionaire who got onto the stage by spending big money, said his prior investments in coal and oil and gas helped to qualify him to make climate change his number one priority. He said he had divested himself from those kinds of holdings a long time ago.
And I'm still shocked that I'm the only person on this stage who will say this. I would declare a state of emergency on day one on climate. I would do it from the standpoint of environmental justice and make sure we go to the Black and Brown communities where you can't breathe the air or drink the water that comes out of the tap safely. But I also know this. We're going to create millions of good-paying union jobs across this country. It's going to be the biggest job program in American history.
Once again, Steyer said that 10 years ago, he disinvested in fossil fuels. Now, Elizabeth Warren was next. She had a promise to roll back those Trump rollbacks we heard about earlier.
Climate change threatens every living thing on this planet, and the urgency of the moment cannot be overstated. I will do everything a president can do all by herself on the first day. I will roll back the environmental changes that Donald Trump is putting in place. I will stop all new drilling and mining on federal lands and offshore drilling. That'll help us get in the right directions. I'll bring in the farmers. Farmers can be part of the climate solution.
Next up, Amy Klobuchar, who claimed a 100% rating from the League of Conservation Voters, but then she had to explain why she would not abolish fracking for natural gas.
When it comes to the issue of fracking, I actually see natural gas as a transition fuel. It's a transition fuel to where we get to carbon neutral. Nearly every one of us has a plan that is very similar, and that is to get to carbon neutral by 2045 to 2050, to get to, by 2030, to a 45% reduction. And I want to add one thing that no one's really answered. When we do this, we have to make sure that we make people whole. And when we put a tax on carbon, which we will do either through cap and trade or through a renewable electricity standard or through a fee on carbon,
you,
then we
Klobuchar.
Have to make sure the money
Senator
goes back.
Klobuchar was the only candidate who mentioned a carbon tax. Bernie Sanders cited fires in Australia and California to warn about an uninhabitable and unhealthy planet.
This is, of course, a national crisis. I've introduced legislation to indicate it's a national crisis. We have got to take on the fossil fuel industry and all of their lies and tell them that their short-term profits are not more important than the future of this planet. That's what the Green New Deal does. That's what my legislation does. And that is what we have to do.
Finally, Joe Biden, who claimed a long history with the issue.
My response is, back in 1986, I introduced the first climate change bill. And check PolitiFact, they said it was a game changer. We can create, and this is where I agree with Tom, we can create millions of good-paying jobs. We're the only country in the world that's ever taken great crisis and turned it into great opportunity. And one of the ways to do it is with farmers here in Iowa, by making them the first group in the world to get to net zero emissions, by paying them for planting and absorbing carbon in their fields right away. There's more to say, but I know
a key part of your mission.
So let me go back to Mark Hertzgaard again with covering climate now and the nation magazine. What do you think is the impact of that on voters? And what did they learn about climate change and the importance of it in this presidential campaign?
I think it's hard to know that, Warren, certainly on just the day after, you know, how many people were watching. This is now the seventh Democratic presidential debate we've had. How many people were still watching at the end of the debate when most of the climate conversation took place? You know, I must say, every debate they have been beating this horse of the health care issue over and over again, to where I suspect a lot of people had probably tuned out by then. That said, I think it is all to the good that at least we are seeing climate change treated as a primary issue now in the conversation about the 2020 presidential race. The big question, I think, facing the media, though, is will that be true as they examine the candidacy of President Donald Trump, who has been, you know, absolutely vociferous in reversing the climate initiatives of previous administrations, who has been a climate denier, and who, frankly, if there's 4 more years of Donald Trump, it's very, very difficult to see how the planet will escape really, really dramatic climate damages. So it seems to me that the press has to be pointing that out going forward. And we'll see if they're up to that task in the months to come.
Let's talk a bit about the substance of what the candidates actually said. And it seems to me that the most controversial things that arose came from Amy Klobuchar. She talked about the tax on carbon, and she also defended the idea of fracking because natural gas, she said, was sort of a transitional fuel. Those are things worth talking about, are they not?
Yeah, I was surprised that Klobuchar said that about the transition fuel. That unfortunately betrays she's way behind, like 5 years behind on the science. It's been clear now for 5 years that while, yes, back in the 1990s and even the 2010s, people were saying, well-intentioned and informed people were saying that natural gas could be a transition fuel. Nobody among the climate specialists and the scientists takes that seriously anymore because there are so many leaks from the methane production, particularly around fracking. So I think she really misstated that.
What about the idea of a carbon tax? That is said by some to be the most efficient way to raise the necessary money, but it's also one of the most difficult things politically.
Yes, I mean, you're right, Warren. That's a very controversial thing. I think she could have taken a stronger approach there that would certainly have resonated with Democratic voters, by saying it's not a tax, but rather what is called a cap and dividend, where essentially, yes, you raise the prices across the economy of coal, oil, natural gas, fuels, but you then restore that money to the American people so that you cap the amount of fossil fuels being used and then you pay dividend to the American people, just like our fellow citizens in Alaska get a dividend every year from the oil production there. Citizens in all 50 states would get a dividend check from the United States to cover the increased costs that would be collected by the government by raising these prices. And economic analysis finds that, you know, all but the very wealthiest Americans would actually come out economically ahead in doing that. And so I'm a little surprised that she wouldn't have chosen that route instead. And this is one of the ways that the Green New Deal that is proposed by Bernie Sanders is also, that's kind of the gold standard in terms of climate policy now. It's the only position, frankly, that matches the science, which says that we've got to, if we're going to keep the temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius, that we've got to get to, got to cut the emissions globally by 50% within the next 10 years. And the way Sanders does that is that, unlike any of the other candidates, he includes a big effort as part of the Green New Deal to not just green the U.S. economy, but to help green the economies of India, Brazil, China, and a lot of these very rapidly growing developing countries that are currently on board to choose coal rather than alternative energy. So, I think, you know, this is one of those cases where I really wish that the CNN had listened to people and said, why don't we have an entire debate on climate change? This is the defining issue of our time. It's hard to get into these specifics and nuances when you're cramming the discussion into the last 20 minutes of a debate that has been mainly taken up with foreign policy and health care.
Can't blame the candidates for that, obviously, but you probably know more about their individual positions and plans. As you indicated, Bernie Sanders has the Green New Deal. Are there any that have proposals that compete with that in terms of this issue and whether or not it would be effective, not just in the United States, but worldwide?
Sanders is the only one that has that robust of an international component to his Green New Deal. That said, Elizabeth Warren's Green New Deal, which is essentially pretty close to Bernie's in terms of the domestic aspect of it. Biden, much less. Buttigieg, much, much less. Buttigieg envisions a green infrastructure plan, which is good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough to really meet the scientific imperative of limiting that temperature rise well below 2 degrees. And then Tom Steyer is essentially also proposing what amounts to a Green New Deal, and he talks about the millions of jobs that would be created. What I think is rhetorically effective on his part, on Steyer's part, was that he talks about, I will declare a climate emergency on day one. I think that's the kind of very straightforward, concise statement that the average voter can hear and say, oh, okay, that sounds like somebody who knows what he's talking about and is going to do what he says.
What does a state of emergency mean?
Well, that's to be decided. And, you know, for example, the British government has declared a climate emergency. And so at one level, it is simply rhetorical. But of course, as the time goes on, you use that rhetoric to say, okay, here's the policies that we will follow to get there. In the case of Steyer, he's talking about initially a lot of executive actions by the president, and Elizabeth Warren mentioned the same thing about stopping drilling on public lands, for example. I'm sure that he would then fold a Green New Deal proposal into that same emergency. I think basically when you talk about a climate emergency, it is a statement of vision and kind of inspiration to the public and to the rest of the government to say, look, we need to focus on this in an urgent, comprehensive way.
You said that there was a certain demand on the part of voters to hear more about this subject and that CNN had failed to listen to that. My understanding, though, is that a lot of people, yeah, they know about climate change, but they find it so scary, so intimidating, that they don't want to talk about it. They want to say, you know, I can't do anything about it, therefore, let's talk about something else.
I think that has been true in the past, Warren, but I think that the opinion is changing very quickly on climate in the last 6 to 8 months, and it's largely, I think, because of the actions of Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who's leading all these climate strikes around the world, and young people standing up and saying, hey, we care about this, you have to do something. And in fact, it's interesting now, in this country, in the United States, the latest polling shows that if you're under the age of 40, it doesn't matter very much whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent. You care about climate change, and you want the media to be talking about this. We're following this very closely, covering climate now, and our colleagues at CBS News did a public opinion poll about this recently. And yes, there's some difference among younger Republicans. It's about, I think, 56% who think that we need to talk more about this, and among younger Democrats, it's about 86%. But the overall trend line is clear, and people want to hear about this. And this is, again, the doom and gloom thing. That's a little bit on us in the media. We have to be talking not just about the science and, admittedly, the very grim aspects of that, as we're seeing play out in Australia right now, but we have to be talking about the solutions and the fact that, as Tom Steyer said last night, we can turn the climate crisis into the biggest jobs-producing opportunity in American history. And that message has not really, I think, been adequately reported by the media. It's not our job to cheerlead, but we should be telling voters exactly what the Green New Deal would do and that opportunity. And I think we've fallen short on that front.
Well, Joe Biden also said we can create millions of good-paying jobs. We just heard about it. He said this could be a great opportunity. Where are these jobs? What are they talking about? What are you talking about?
Sure. Right now, the fastest growing sector well, until recently with Donald Trump's trade war in China, but the solar installation was the fastest growing job sector in the United States. Wind is wind turbines is incredibly a job employment. But I think going forward, the bigger opportunity is in something that is, granted, not very sexy. It doesn't sound sexy to talk about energy efficiency, but that's where the biggest gains will be, by which I mean re-insulating your house, changing out the windows so that they are energy efficient and you don't basically air condition or heat the outdoors rather than the inside of your house. Those are all jobs that will require it's construction, it's going into your house, it's basically rewiring the buildings and factories and so forth from the ground up, putting in more efficient appliances, all of these things. These are very labor-intensive jobs. You can't outsource them to China. And if they are done properly, which all the Democratic candidates say they would support union rights, they will be good-paying jobs as well.
So once again, climate change will affect every aspect of the way we live and no doubt get into the political campaign as well as the race for the White House continues. Mark Hertzgard, great to have you back on our program. Again, Executive Director of Covering Climate Now, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth.
Thank you so much, Warren.
We're going to take a very brief break, and then, once again, as we promised, we'll come back and talk more about what Chief Justice John Roberts might have to do or not do in the trial of President Trump. Back in a moment with To the Point. Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Two articles of impeachment are on their way from the House, which formerly lodged them against President Trump, to the Senate. It will conduct a trial, possibly as soon as next week. Now, if Trump is convicted, he could be removed from office. All that is according to the Constitution of the United States, which also says the Chief Justice will preside over the trial. But that's all it says. It does not provide any instruction as to what it means for a Chief Justice to preside. Joan Biskupic is legal analyst for CNN. She's written a biography of the current Chief Justice. It's called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Welcome, Joan Biskupic.
Thank you, Warren.
This is only the third time that this has happened to a Chief Justice, and he's been asked to preside over such a trial. What do we know about John Roberts that might tell us about how he's going to handle it?
First, I think that the Senate rules themselves and past practice will confine his responsibility to mostly a ministerial one. He's not sitting there as a judge in any way, as a judge, a justice, a juror. He is there to preside. And when Chief Justice William Rehnquist oversaw the 1999 Bill Clinton impeachment trial, he emphasized that his role was not substantive, it was more ministerial. And I think John Roberts is going to try to take a page from that. Under the Senate rules, the chief will not have any kind of vote, of course, but he may rule on questions of evidence, whether evidence presented is material or relevant. So he could end up in the hot seat, so to speak, on some issues of evidence and witnesses. However, the Chief Justice's decision could be overruled by a majority vote of the full Senate, because the bottom line, Warren, under our Constitution and Supreme Court precedent in this area, this is the Senate's show. And as I said, Chief Justice Rehnquist did not want to claim any unusual authority here, and I don't think John Roberts will either, even though we are in much more polarized times.
Rehnquist famously said something along the lines of, "I did very little and I did it very well."
Yes, he took a page from Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe.
The house of his throughout the war did nothing in particular and did it very well.
Just as an aside, Warren, you probably remember that when he showed up, he was wearing his black robe with the four stripes, gold stripes on each of his sleeves. He had done that a few years before the 1999 impeachment trial. inspired by a character in Iolanthe, but it was also a line from Iolanthe that he would often use, and that was, he did nothing in particular and did it very well.
So you think Roberts will go along with that. Well, what if the Senate rules against allowing anybody to testify, even though there has been growing pressure for that to happen, particularly with regard to the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton?
If it gets tossed to the chief, and I think that's a very big if, because under the 1999 practice, the Senate Majority Leader and Minority Leader work all these out, because, again, the Senate operates, you know, by majority rule. So I think the dispute is going to be mainly between the House managers, obviously all Democrats, and the Senate leaders, Republicans, and that's where the skirmish will be. Now, if any senator, likely a Democratic senator or any of the Democratic House managers, implore the Chief Justice as the presiding officer to make some sort of ruling on whether a witness should have to be appear, I wonder if the chief would even take that on. He might just say, let's put that to a vote of the Senate, or, you know, the Senate has already decided it doesn't want witnesses, and I'm not going to claim that authority. Now, there was one point in 1999 where one of the Democratic senators was trying to get Rehnquist to intervene on, frankly, a matter that seems so much smaller today, but he refused to assert any great authority, saying in this one episode he would claim authority only when, quote, its exercise was clearly warranted. So he deliberately stayed in the backdrop. Now, he dealt a lot with the parliamentarian to keep the trains running and to try to keep things moving smoothly, but he took steps not to be put on the spot to do anything that would control the outcome of whether the president, in that case, Bill Clinton, was convicted or acquitted, just like I believe John Roberts would try to do nothing that would steer the ultimate resolution for Donald Trump toward a conviction or acquittal.
Okay, let's step forward to what's going on at this moment. Here is Nancy Pelosi, after she has held for quite a long time the charges against the president, hasn't sent them over to the Senate. Here's what she's saying now.
We have confidence in our case that it is impeachable, and this president is impeached for life, regardless of any gamesmanship on the part of Mitch McConnell.
Now, as to McConnell, he, of course, has been very critical of the speaker for not sending over the articles sooner. And here's his conclusion about that.
In terms of influencing Senate proceedings, this strange gambit has achieved absolutely nothing.
Okay, that may be debatable. But what about this? McConnell has been conspiring, if you will. That's probably a loaded term to use. But he's been talking to the defense in this matter, namely the president's lawyers at the White House. That's not something that the foreman of the jury does in a regular trial. So back to John Roberts, who has said so often that judges should be favorable to neither party, one or the other. How comfortable is he going to be in a situation where the majority leader has been dealing with what is essentially the defense?
Well, I think John Roberts' sentiment about Mitch McConnell will be kept to John Roberts. He has gone out of his way to say nothing about, the current situation. Now, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a televised interview in December, was asked exactly about that, Warren. It was right around the time when Mitch McConnell had made some comments about how, you know, this isn't going to be impartial. It's not supposed to be impartial. It's a different kind of trial we've got going here. And Justice Ginsburg, who doesn't have the same check on herself as the chief does. The chief is obviously rather reserved and very cautious about what he says, whereas Ruth Bader Ginsburg likes to call it as she sees it. She said in a normal trial, if a judge or juror said he couldn't be impartial, that would be the end of that. So, but for, you know, Mitch McConnell, frankly, gets to say whatever he wants to say. He's running it, and his constituents might think it's fine. people out in the country might think it's horrendous that he would reveal such bias early on, but this is a different kind of trial. It is the Senate's trial, and he's going to do what he can get a majority to go along with. Now, will that inspire confidence among the public at large? I think that's a very real question.
Because, as you've said again and again, and as the Constitution indicates, this may be called a trial, but it's not like the trials that we are familiar with. Our expectations will not be fulfilled in the sense that the judge is going to have ultimate authority. And in fact, as you've said, and as I understand it, whatever happens and whatever he does, he can be overruled by 51 senators.
That's exactly right. And there's an important case in 1993 that some of your listeners might be aware of, but I always like to call it the other Nixon case, because when we're talking about presidential privilege and powers and impeachment, we think of the 1974 U.S. v. Nixon case, which was the famous Watergate tapes case that ended up in a ruling against Richard Nixon and led swiftly to his resignation over Watergate. But in 1993, there was another case, Nixon versus U.S., brought by a man by the name of Walter Nixon, who was a judge, a federal judge, who had been found guilty of, I think, bribery and corruption. And the House of Representatives voted to impeach him because, as you know well, Warren, federal judges are appointed for life and can only be removed with impeachment. So he's impeached in the House in the early 90s. He goes to a Senate trial, and the senators, you know, it's not the president, it's a federal judge, and they've handled a handful of federal judicial impeachments. The senators have a committee take evidence, and then they end up convicting him to remove him from office. And Walter Nixon went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said, the full Senate should have heard my case. They shouldn't have handled part of it with a committee, and I want to challenge their procedures. And what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1993, with Chief Justice William Rehnquist writing the opinion, was that it is the sole authority of the Senate to decide how it wants to run its impeachment trial, and the U.S. Supreme Court is not going to intervene. So you have Supreme Court precedent reinforcing that notion that the sole responsibility on whether a president is convicted or acquitted is the Senate. And here's another little tidbit from 1999 when William Rehnquist was presiding over the Bill Clinton impeachment trial. At one point, a Democratic senator objected to the fact that the House managers, in effect operating as prosecutors, kept referring to the senators as jurors. And one of the Democrats said, you know, make them stop calling us jurors. We're more than jurors here. And Rehnquist agreed. He said the Senate is not simply a jury. It is a court in this case. It is the decider.
What if the Senate votes 50-50 on the issue of whether John Bolton should testify or on some other issue? Who breaks the tie?
Not the Chief Justice. No one breaks a tie. A tie would be a loss. I believe that back in the 1868 trial of Andrew Johnson, that Chief Justice Chase did break ties in the Senate. But that move was very controversial. And the current Senate rules definitely do not give the presiding officer any power of a vote. And that was the case for Chief Justice Rehnquist in the President Clinton impeachment. He has no, you know, I hate to say never on anything in this atmosphere, Warren, but, you know, the senators could change their rules somehow. But right now, under the modern interpretation of the Senate rules and the power of the Senate and the power of the presiding officer, the Chief Justice cannot break a tie. And I saw a news report that referenced something that would raise that possibility. And I went back and read the Senate rules, and then I checked in with an impeachment scholar. And I feel pretty confident in telling you that Chief Justice John Roberts is going to break no tie, especially when it comes to whether someone like John Bolton would testify.
What's this going to look like? And if people want to watch it on TV, what are they going to see? What are they going to hear?
Okay, so this is this is going to be exciting because across the street at the Supreme Court, cameras aren't allowed. The Chief Justice does most of his work, you know, in the marble confines of his chamber, and even during oral arguments, which are public, no cameras are allowed in. So what viewers will see on their television sets, or however they get, you know, C-SPAN and all the networks, will be the Chief Justice coming in. He'll sit up on the dais, he'll stand there, he'll take an oath of office, and then he will administer an oath to all the senators and then have them sign an oath book, and he will be up there presiding. So they will actually see John Roberts much more than they see him now. In fact, the last time most Americans saw John Roberts was, in plain sight, would have been in 2005 when he testified for his confirmation hearing to be Chief Justice. So this will be a whole different view. And I am sure he will want to project fairness and impartiality.
Even though he may be presiding over a trial that isn't very fair and impartial.
No, and the other thing is, across the street where he normally works, the justices are set to take up several cases involving Donald Trump, where there have been subpoenas issued for his tax returns and other financial papers. So the chief is completely embroiled in real disputes that he will actually cast a vote on over at the Supreme Court, while on the Senate side, presiding over this trial of whether Donald Trump is removed from office. And this would be a good time to remind everyone that it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate to find to convict a president after he's been served with these articles of impeachment. So frankly, I think we know what the outcome of this will be, and Nancy Pelosi is right that Donald Trump will always have been impeached. He's impeached for life, but it's unlikely at this point that he will be convicted and removed from office.
And meantime, the Chief Justice will be doing one thing on one side of the street and something very different on the other side of the street.
That's exactly right. And people should realize that he has two distinct roles, one as a true judicial officer at the Supreme Court, where he has a vote and he will be steering the outcome of a case, and one when he's presiding and much more ministerial.
Joan Biskupic is legal analyst for CNN. She's written a biography of the current Chief Justice. It's called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts, his life more turbulent than ever. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren. Bye-bye.
Today's To the Point was produced by Andrea Brody, with theme music from Chris Watherspoon, our engineers Chuck Prevetari. All our other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. And you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at WarrenAlney1. You can also get us at tothepoint_KCRW. And we're on Facebook as well. Join us again.